Welcome to Jam Live, the show featuring concerts and events presented by Junction Arts and Music Society in Haines Junction, Yukon. I am Maria Leniak. Since 2003, the Kluane Mountain Bluegrass Festival has presented amazing music from the finest artists in bluegrass, such as Blue Highway, Balsam Range, and Steep Canyon Rangers. And for the first time this year, Jam Live recorded some of the fantastic performances for this radio show. Like all music genres, the bluegrass sound is colored by the musician's personal life and their lives as professional musicians. We thought you'd be interested in exploring with us some of this background. So, who better than past producer of the Bluegrass Festival, Steve Gedrose, to get together for a chat with members of each of the five bands Jam Live is featuring from this year's festival. In this episode, Steve is talking to the Abrams brothers from Kingston, Ontario. John and James, the Abrams brothers, are the fourth generation of professional musicians in their family. Barely into their 20s, and they've been touring for over a decade. The brothers come from a strong tradition of bluegrass and Americana music, and have since created a signature sound that brings country, rock, and pop all together in one place. In performance, John and James are joined by Cam Giraud and Jason Mercer. We recorded this interview during the festival on June 13, 2015, at the crowded St. Elias Convention Center in Haines Junction, Yukon.
My name is Steve Gedrose, and we're coming to you live from the 2015 Kluane Mountain Bluegrass Festival here in downtown Haines Junction, Yukon. My guests are the leaders of the Abrams Brothers. That's John, who sings and plays guitar and mandolin, I gather, his brother James, who plays fiddle, guitar, banjo, pretty much anything with strings.
Yeah, exactly. I brought a mandolin as well. Yeah. We'll be picking that up.
Okay. So we didn't see that last night, but hi, guys, and thanks very much for coming in and doing this interview with
us. Thanks for having us. This is great.
I really appreciate it very much. I was curious about the band you brought. I know Jason, but I don't know Cam. What's his last name?
Cam Giroux, G-I-R-I-U-X. Yeah. Cam's a great drummer. He's played with all kinds of fantastic artists across Canada. And actually, his wife is Susie from Oh Susanna.
Of course.
So there's a really tight Canadian musician connection, certainly, between all of us. And Jason's in Ron Sexsmith's band. He's played with Ronnie DeFranco over the years. And so we were really supported by some great, talented guys. We're very thankful that they could make it up to Haines Junction with us.
Well, the first thing that I noticed that you're from Kingston, and I was going to ask you, do you know Luther Wright?
Oh, of course.
And then you show
Everybody
up with two
Luther
guys
Wright.
Who are the former Wrongs.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, yeah, exactly. He has a new record that I think is coming out soon or just came out, and I was able to play some fiddle on a couple of the tracks. And so I'm excited for
James is a former Wrong man. He's kind of he's
yeah, of course.
I think so many people are.
That's pretty exciting.
We played a few if he plays around Kingston, we've been able to go out and play with him sometimes. Yeah. So yeah, we know him very well.
Oh,
you know,
great.
I think it's just indicative of the community of musicians that live in Kingston, Ontario, and get to travel this country, and it's really neat that we've got all these musicians that come together and then all live in the area.
Yes.
And so we're you know, certainly influenced by each other, and we you know, sort of we end up playing with each other at some point.
Great. Well, Luther and Jason were here for a Home Roots tour, and that's how I first met them. And actually, Luther used to live in Dawson City for a time.
Yeah, that's
right. A very iconic building that used to be a brothel, and I'm sure he has lots of stories about that.
So we
needn't go into all that, but it's called Bombay Peggy's now. It's totally reclaimed as a bar and kind of boutique hotel, so it's very
amazing.
Special.
Funny.
And I think he was able to play there last time he was up. So I've been reading about your background, and I know you've talked about this in performance, but fourth generation of professional musicians.
Yeah.
Was there any doubt that you guys would play music?
You know, I don't think so. You know, James and I, we were really young when we started playing music. James was 6 and I was almost 9 when we started playing violin. And even before that, we were sort of just singing songs together, old gospel songs. And so with our family, it really just started. They'd be jamming and rehearsing on Wednesday evenings out in Sydenham, Ontario, where our grandparents live. And James and I would sit there at the table and we'd be drawing pictures or something when we were younger and just passing the time while they were practicing. And we sort of just, we got to the point where we thought, let's just jump in and join in on this. You know,
yes.
We had already started to play Suzuki violin and started playing classically on the violin. But we thought, you know, this is a tradition that our family is doing. They're already three generations in playing gospel music particularly, but also bluegrass, a lot of bluegrass music and a little bit of old country music. And so we sort of just immediately were drawn to that style. And so that family harmony became a pivotal part of our lives, not just our music, but our lives in general. And so that that's how we got into music.
Great. I appreciate that very much. You know, this also brings up the strong tradition of sibling-based groups in bluegrass. I mean, that's Osborne Brothers, you can go on and on, Stanley Brothers, on and on.
Leuven Brothers, we grew up on
Leuven Brothers.
Yeah,
okay.
Through. Yeah, sitting in the backseat of our grandparents' station wagon, that's how we learned how to sing harmony, was singing to, like, the great classic Leuven Brothers songs and on the way to swimming lessons.
Okay,
that's how,
yes,
that's how it started.
Okay. Because there really is something special about how brothers harmonize, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree, definitely. And we're very fortunate to have that connection between the two of us.
Okay. Another question I was going to ask is, are there brother bands that inspired you? You've kind of touched on Leuven's. Are there others?
Jim and Jesse McReynolds.
Yes, of course.
Big. Actually, there's a interesting story. When we were younger, we had a wonderful opportunity to even be asked the question by our parents if we would prefer to have a bus or a pool.
Oh.
We knew that the bus was a bus that was owned and was a bus that Jim and Jesse used to use.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it was
their touring vehicle.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So we knew that. Because, of course, having grown up and listening to them, we were still young at the time. But do you remember how old we were, John?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think
we were only a couple.
I was in grade 7,
into,
so yeah. I was like 12
Anyways,
or 13 when we got
we
the
knew
bus.
That it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be able to have Jim and Jesse's bus. And so we chose the bus, and we were so happy to... choose that and have a vehicle to ride around in as a family with the three generations, our grandfather and our dad and our mom and all of our family to be able to go to bluegrass festivals on this bus. And anyway, so Jim and Jesse definitely and getting to know Jesse after that and be able to jam and those sorts of things, they were definitely a brother group that definitely inspired us.
Well, and Jesse became a real sort of mentor to us in bluegrass, and just we kept good contact with him, and I think that bus became both literally and metaphorically, if you will, the vehicle to our success in bluegrass, because we knew playing bluegrass music, considering it's very much an American art form. Absolutely. I mean, that the real opportunity for us to get down into the United States and learn from where they literally eat, breathe, and sleep this music was the only way that we could really... learn it properly. And so that's what we ended up doing when we were younger. We toured, more in the United States even than Canada at that time, playing bluegrass festivals all over the U.S., down in the South. We opened the Ralph Stanley Museum in Clintwood, Virginia with Ralph when they opened it up.
Wow.
We did, the Grand Ole Opry. We did the Station Inn. Like, all those spots were early in our career. And it became... we had so many great mentors in bluegrass music because, of course, just to get back to your question, not just brother acts that influence us, but, the thing about bluegrass music is that it's so accessible. The artists are so accessible, right? I mean...
And it is an oral tradition.
Yeah, James and I, we remember a time sitting backstage in at a festival in Maine with Doc Watson, and we sat there for 45 minutes, and he just took 45 minutes with James and I just to talk to us
just
about the business,
and
talk to us about music and bluegrass and what it meant,
and
it's times like those, where we sit, and we remember those times where we spent, in another one we were just thinking the other day that really was a monumental part, I think, in our career. And it was something very small, but it was a big thing for James and I. After having grown up listening to the Leuven Brothers, we played, this wasn't actually that long ago, it was only a year or two before Charlie Louvin passed away.
Right.
And Charlie came up to us at a show, we were playing in Bellbuckle, Tennessee, and we'd heard that he was there, but he was sort of standing at the back watching, and he came up to us after the show, and he had tears in his eyes, and he said to James and I, he said, listening to you guys sing harmony reminded me of me and my brother.
Wow.
And like, whether that was true or not, whether it's true that we're, I mean, like, we'd love to be as great as the Louvin brothers, you know what I mean? Like, but for him to say that we reminded him of him and his brother, was a moment that we said, of course, considering that that's all, those are the guys we listened to when we were younger. That was a moment where we thought, you know, we're doing the right thing, I think. You know, this is what
I would say that's a pretty good indication.
You know? So we were fortunate. The beautiful thing about bluegrass music is that accessibility. And so buying that bus from Jesse, touring throughout the States, that was our music education.
Very
bluegrass. And then even though we play our own style of music now, that's still at the heart and soul of what we do.
Very interesting. I know that you are started on classical violin. Does that still weigh in? Do you still do any classical music or exercises or things?
Well, I can't speak for John. I know that
John doesn't.
Yeah.
Okay. Although I love listening to classical music. I keep, for sure.
Yeah, there's a little bit in the newer music, but we have done even on our last full album that was our first original record called Northern Redemption. We actually did have some like section, string section stuff, and so I do like to incorporate string sections into songs that we have. So it is, in that sense, it is it's more that's less bluegrass or folk and more sort of classical in the sense that you know you're harmonizing melodies and putting. Putting that sort of flavor to a song, so I do still do some classical with, and I have a five string as well as a four string, so that gives me the ability to have sort of like a violin and a viola.
Of course, yes.
And,
James composes a lot of pieces at home as well. So I hear him upstairs, and we live together. Place downtown and his third floor room. I can hear him just like coming up with these classical pieces upstairs, just off the top of his head. It's actually pretty incredible.
But also in middle school, I went to an arts middle school and I played double bass. So so I can play double bass as well. And I've recently been looking to buy a cello so that I could play all these string instruments and then be able
to four in the section.
Right pieces with all the string instruments. So I still do some of that. So
very interesting. You were talking about your more recent album, but I read a very positive comment from Arlo Guthrie about your 2008 recording Blue on Brown.
Right.
And he said, this band is way too young to be playing so good. I know I'll be hearing from the Abrams brothers for a long time. That must be pretty cool to hear that kind of comment.
Arlo's a very cool guy. And we were fortunate to play a couple shows with him. Actually, just before we released that record, and we were still sort of getting the album art together for that, and we just sort of asked, and we said, you know, Arlo, would you be willing to you know, maybe say something? Or we just sort of didn't know what he might have had in mind, and he said, yeah, sure, I'd love to write sort of liner notes, and we thought, oh, that's great, wow, okay. So he ended up sort of taking it home, and he came up with, if you get a chance to buy the record, Blue on Brown, and you read the liner notes, without going into too much detail, it's a very Arlo liner note.
I get that.
It's amazing, and I think it was just so beautifully written. And again, that's just another example of people in our career at certain junctures that have been supportive and have confirmed what we're doing and just made us feel encouraged. You know, another. I guess the more recent example would be on the Northern Redemption record. We did Viva La Vida, the Coldplay song. We did sort of a country rock version of it, and we were fortunate enough to have a video made in CMT in the States and Canada. They played it quite a few times, and so that was great. But in order to get a music video made for this thing, we had to run it by Coldplay's people.
Sure.
Because you can just do a song, but to get a sync license for a video is a whole other world.
Of course.
Anyway, we were fortunate enough to get the song to the guys, to Chris, Johnny, Will, and Guy, while they were touring in Australia at the time. And we got word back from them that they loved our version, and they just said, just, you don't have to buy a sync license, just go ahead and do it.
No kidding.
So, you know, being fans ourselves too, just of their Absolutely. Music and their creativity and their ability to connect with huge audiences, kind of like you too, the ability to connect with huge audiences and have songs that people, that communicate so clearly, you know, a theme or a feeling or an emotion that people can, in the audience can go, that's me, you know, that's what we always aspire to with our own songs. And so to have them say that was like, oh, great, you know, this
yes.
is just, again, feeling like we're on the right track.
So Northern Redemption was largely original material.
It was. And so that was actually one of the only, that and the Alex Chilton song 13 by the band Big Star. We did a cover of that as well.
So is this the direction the group is going towards, more original stuff?
Oh, yeah. Actually, our all of the new material that we have right now that we've just come out of the studio doing, and we actually have a sort of a short EP available for that here at the festival. It's all stuff that we've written, and
okay.
we're doing all our songs with Gavin Brown. So he's
I was just going to ask you about that connection.
Yeah, exactly. He's so he's a phenomenal producer. I mean, he's done Bare Naked Ladies, Tragically Hip, Metric, Lady Gaga in the Midway State, and so he's a fantastic pop rock producer. And so we started working with him a little over a year ago on new songs, new material. And it's been an amazing sort of bridging of two worlds, if you will.
Yes.
Having come from, you know, bluegrass, folk, old country, and this past that we've definitely delved into here today. And marrying that with, like, this pop rock sensibility, the architecture of songs designed for radio and that sort of thing, but maintaining that history and that story that we have at the same time has been an amazing process, and a very unique one at that. Very different than our other records.
Yes, I was going to get to that. The earlier videos and audio clips I heard were straight up bluegrass.
Exactly, yeah.
Now you guys have made history by being the first band at the Kluane Mountain Bluegrass Festival to have a drummer.
Well, are we the first band?
Absolutely.
Wow.
First. I mean,
there
this
you
was
go.
Considered
breaking sacrilege ground here.
Not long ago.
Well,
and,
yeah.
You know, when I hear Cam play, I get it.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
It really drives the group.
Well, we also don't, you know, make any claim to say that what we do with drums is, you know, certainly by any means traditional bluegrass, or even can we really call it, you know, quote unquote bluegrass without an ellipsis at the end, you know, or a slash. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I think that's the thing for us. It's like bluegrass slash rock, bluegrass slash folk rock, or whatever. But we know and we respect the art form
Absolutely.
Of bluegrass, and having grown up playing it in the South of the United States, we know it's a very specific thing. That having been said, though, it's fertile ground.
Yes.
And I think the metaphor of it being, you know, called bluegrass is sort of interesting, because it's fertile ground for growth, always. And,
yes.
And you know, you look back at video footage of in the 70s of the Osborne Brothers, mm-hmm. and you know, the Country Gentlemen, and even Bill Monroe, and different bands that at, you know, some of these really cutting-edge festivals when bluegrass was, like, strong and the hippie movement was surrounding it, they'd have drums on stage or organ on stage,
yes.
sometimes singing, like, Country Roads by John Denver, or,
yes.
you know, different things like that. And I think you know, the last thing I'll just say about that is just, I think the, you know, it's most important not to regulate an art form.
Yes.
Art needs to be free to take on its own form. And bluegrass is a thing, and the beautiful thing is it can be so many things at the same time. It can merge
Absolutely.
With so many things and maintain its integrity.
Yeah.
I think that's what people fear, is that it will lose integrity, but it can never lose integrity.
In any musical genre, how things advance is young people respect the tradition, but bring in what they're feeling, what they're
exactly.
hearing.
Right.
And that is instrumentation, lyrical content, all kinds of themes, all
yeah.
kinds of different things.
Like,
I think we have to go there.
I think my thing is, you know, Nirvana was way different than Elvis Presley, but it all falls under the umbrella of rock and roll.
Yes.
I mean? And bluegrass is just as important a genre in the world of music as, I believe this, as rock and roll and country music. I mean, it's fundamental to the American identity and beyond, to now in parts of Canada, here in, you know, Haines Junction. You know, it's fundamental
yes.
to people's identity, right?
Yes.
So, So allowing it to have the freedom to move where it needs to is key.
And, you know, at the genesis of bluegrass, it itself was quite a radical thing.
Absolutely. Right?
So, you know,
absolutely.
It's taking those steps that create different genres of music and variations of genres that create, you know, the music that we love today.
Yeah, yes. I mean, you know, Bill Monroe, whether he intended it or not, I'm going to assume he probably didn't, but, you know, it was maybe one of the most, you know, like James said, radical. I think it's a great word because it was almost a political movement.
Yes.
At the same time as a music movement.
Yes.
I mean, he was bringing together, hillbilly string band music and, you know, like distinctly white music from the mountains with African American music. You know,
from the mountains and from the British Isles.
Exactly, from the British Isles. Well, originally, certainly.
Yes.
You know, like that,
yes.
That all comes from there. That's the white
English
man.
Murder ballads.
Exactly.
Scottish, Irish, Philippines.
But then you've got banjo, which originated in Africa.
Yes.
You've got the Delta Blues Incorporated. You've got, you know, original jazz. You've got the sounds
pentatonic.
Pentatonic scales. Like
yes.
Robert Johnson, that stuff is all put into the same melting pot of bluegrass. So,
and that
funny
is
enough,
that,
yeah.
It's like, that's a radical idea.
Yeah, yeah, and the, you know, so...
For when, a bunch of white guys.
Well,
yeah.
consider yeah. Where geographically Bill Monroe was at the
yes.
time.
Yes.
Bringing black music and white music into the same concert?
Yes.
I mean, you know, we're still segregated in many of the states in the
yes.
States, but if you think about that, that was a really radical move and
yes.
highly respectable. So I think in homage to Bill Monroe, it's important that if you're going to forge the music ahead, you have to try and make those same synergies as much as possible with other art forms and creating new sounds, because that's certainly what he did.
So incorporating more electric elements, is that just how what you guys hear, or is this an aid of reaching a broader audience, or... What can you talk about?
You know,
that?
I think it's safe to say sort of a number of those things. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, our whole reason for playing music is to try and reach as many people as we can, so that we can hopefully touch people's lives. I mean, really, that's at the heart of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever vessel that needs to, you know, to go in order to be able to be accessible to as many people as possible. We're obviously attracted to that because, you know, communicating these things to as broad an audience as we can is important. And it's also, but that goes with maintaining the integrity of our past and who we are. And so when you listen to this new batch of material, albeit while it works very much on country radio and on pop radio, at the center of it, you know, you're hearing fiddle and banjo and acoustic guitar. I mean,
yes.
that's at the core of the music. That's
yeah.
you know,
music,
and the vocal harmonies.
Harmonies. Yeah,
exactly.
Exactly. Musically, we really, except for adding drums and that rhythmic element. From what the core, as John mentioned, it's all acoustically driven.
Yeah, yes.
Like we have acoustic fiddle and acoustic guitar and acoustic banjo and you know, Jason Mercer, who's playing here with us, you know, is playing an acoustic upright bass and as well as an electric bass. So, you know, as John mentioned, it's that core that's acoustically driven.
Yes.
with the rhythmic supplementation of drums, which otherwise in bluegrass is emulated through the chucking of the mandolin and the chucking of the fiddle
and the
those
bass.
Sorts of things. And the
yeah,
bass.
Exactly.
Yes.
So just kind of adding in that rhythmic, you know, supplementing with the drums, but still having an acoustic core. So
yeah, for sure.
It's certainly live. And then on our newest records, that's certainly the core with some other elements of Not entirely electric sounds, but with synth, some synth pads and those, just musically, that's
yeah.
sort of what the,
exactly.
where we've gone so far, but yeah.
Well, you guys bring such energy to your music. Is there someone that has inspired that? I mean, we didn't see the Loom Brothers jumping around and driving it like that. I mean, that's coming from a different source.
Well, you know what? I think that just is, you know, there's a number of sources, but really it's the evolution of our performance. I mean, when we were younger, even still, even if we were confined to microphones, you know, where we weren't plugged in through DIs and, you know, sort of, you know, patch cords and stuff in our guitar that makes us free of mics. So, you know, even when we had mics lined up in the front of the stage, like many bluegrass bands, we still tried to engage the audience as best as possible. And honestly, early going, it was bands like the Lewis Family,
yes.
Right? That
yeah.
You know, there was this one time we were playing with the Lewis Family in the U.S. I think it was at the same festival in Maine that we hung out with Doc Watson, and we had a great set on stage, and they were on right after us, and I remember literally as soon as they step on stage, the clouds come together and just start pouring on the audience.
Wow.
I mean, it was a torrential downpour. And it was funny because it was literally through their entire set, and it almost seemed like as soon as they get off the stage, the clouds parted and it was fine. But, you know, Little Roy Lewis being sort of the jokester of the group, if you will, you know, he particularly, but none of them ever lost that sense of entertainment for the audience. It didn't matter. I mean, they had people leaving, you know, they had some people staying. They performed to that audience as if there was absolutely nothing wrong. It was the same thing playing at the Opry. We were there the same night. I think the Osborne Brothers were playing there that night, and there was a ceiling fan that was going crazy above
okay.
their heads, and it was crazy loud.
Right.
But they never broke stride.
Right.
And so this is sort of a longer way to answer, you know, your question of saying, okay, you know, performance for us is key to being able to connect with the audience, right?
Yes.
And so, you know, plugging in and doing that sort of thing and being able to walk out to the edge of the stage and engage the audience, look at people, smile, that sort of thing, it has roots in our bluegrass past. Even when we were confined to those mics, we were trying to do that as much as possible. But we also worked a lot with Tom Jackson, great performance coach.
Yes, he's been here. I experienced
oh, really?
His
yeah.
workshop. Yeah.
Amazing. Tom's
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, he was really something.
Yeah.
And I was thinking of that last night because he talks about the stage is floating.
Exactly.
If one guy moves forward, the other guy moves back to keep the balance.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it. And Tom, of course, he's worked with Taylor Swift and the band Perry and all kinds of, you know, Lana Del Rey. And so we worked with Tom in Kingston. We brought him up. And that really was a big thing for us, was like, okay, how do we connect with the audience as best as possible? And Tom was like, well, here you go. And so, yeah, I mean, we do a lot more headbanging than the Lubin Brothers did. But, you know, the energy stems from that bluegrass pass. But I think for us, it's about making as powerful and energetic show so people go home almost feeling, in a good way, satisfyingly exhausted. You know, they
right.
leave going, wow, I really got my money's worth. I really got, you know, an experience tonight that I won't forget. You know, that's the thing for us.
I remember Tom saying that, you know, bands put all this time and money into recording, but they don't rehearse their stage show.
Yeah.
You know, they expect the recording to just carry it. Well, mm-hmm.
that's
not the case. And obviously you guys have learned those lessons well.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, well, we get an opportunity, like, we the last couple of years we've been able to tour a lot, so we wanted mm-hmm. to make sure prior to that we did have a better understanding of how to present ourselves, and so we've been able to, and over the years that we've been able to tour, we've been able to implement some of those things, mm-hmm. and some of the things that you naturally do when you're younger, where you may not be inhibited as much to because you're on stage and you sort of take ownership of the little area that you have, and
yes.
And some of those natural things that you may do at a younger age on stage, just sort of fostering those now into the new music that we're playing, and Tom definitely helped
yeah.
with that. So.
Well, and our dad was really good when we were younger too about you know, being, you know, really setting the guidelines of what we needed to be doing and not doing on stage. I mean, he was very much right there for us to do that, you know, like, and you know, we were learning life lessons as we were learning performance lessons.
Excellent.
To be honest
with
you.
Yep.
I mean, getting out after the show and shaking hands and looking people in the eye, all those things we were learning as kids just by the nature of what we were doing. And now, you know, when we play stages that, you know, sometimes, I mean, we're fortunate to have, you know, 40,000 people out in front of us, and the stage is a great big massive stage. I mean, that all pays off now, because when you're, you know, a little dot down on a stage for somebody at the back, you want to make sure that person at the back is having just as good a time as somebody up front, right?
Play the back of the house.
Exactly. So you need to be moving around, you need to be, you know, and you need to be occupying this whole stage. Sometimes they're really big stages, right? But you need to be occupying that whole stage so that somebody back there is really getting as much energy as up front. And
yeah.
And again, that all comes back from, you know, remembers dad saying, look people in the eye.
Yes.
You know? And mom, our mom saying that too. You know, she'd be in the audience all the time and she'd be watching, she'd be saying, boys, you need to remember to smile at people. You need to remember to to nod at people and you know, show gratitude when they clap for you after a solo. Things like that, right?
There's not a lot happening if you don't have an audience.
Exactly.
Exactly.
They are the
exactly.
most important
and
thing to us, right?
So. Yeah, and some of the most special times for us are after the shows when we can go out and meet people.
Definitely.
And you know, and speak to people one-on-one and particularly in the last couple of years when we've been able to tour around the States. Last year, or this past year, we were at home and recording, but the year before that we were in the Midwest, and the year prior to that we started in the East, made our way down into the Southwest United States. Going into different communities and meeting people and meeting people from all, you know, walks of life, it's that in itself has been such an amazing education for John and I, and to meet such wonderful people all over the place and overseas, and that to me is the most special part of being able to tour and play music is meeting people.
Okay, like this kind of leads me into building a fan base.
Yeah.
You guys are obviously young and you're plugged into all social media and all that kind of stuff. What do you feel about streaming sites? Do you participate in that?
Yeah.
What's your philosophy about that?
You know
that,
what? Chris? I think at our stage, James, you can talk about this from your perspective too, but I think from our perspective, certainly where we are right now, we're in a position where we're hoping that our songs can be heard by as many people as possible. I mean, we consider it an honor if somebody wants to get our stuff so badly that they want to stream it online or they want to, you know, this.
Do
so
you,
that,
eh?
Yeah,
it's,
I mean,
it's a pretty controversial subject.
I think that's where we're at.
Really,
it's where things are going. I, you know, there is a bit of an element of the Wild West in the music industry right now. Certainly, it's settled down a little bit from where it was even 6 years ago. But you know, great things can come from that, you know, great creativity and can come from that. And frankly, there's more competition now with social media and with, you know, YouTube, where, you know, people can upload anything to YouTube and be found, you know, whereas there was a lot more that you needed behind you in order to promote your music and get heard 15 years ago.
A lot of people, you know, see it as leveling the playing field.
Yeah.
Is that kind of
so
how you
really
at?
Have to be, you know, to make an exceptional splash, or you have to really play your A game in order to be appreciated, because people's attention spans are much shorter now. And so, I don't know. I
Sad, but true.
Well, it is, but you know, I see it as an opportunity to step up to the plate and really, you know, hone your music and make your music as best as it can be. And I think that's at least, you know, where I'm at. I don't know.
Yeah,
where you
no, that's... It. Well, it's certainly it's a very long conversation for sure, and it's and you know what, the way that technology has the point that we're at here is, it's certainly a double-edged sword, and there are many people that at one end of the spectrum that are getting a leg up, and then there's others on the other end of the spectrum that are losing a lot of value for the product that they produce.
That's true. That's true.
As John was saying, he's speaking from our perspective, and at the position that we're at.
And that's not everybody's perspective.
It,
I can understand.
It's
that.
Very the outlets that we have are very useful to us. But I do know, and we know that there are certainly people that are. That are losing the worth of the mm-hmm. great products that they produce. So we are definitely respectful.
But if we're talking about a live fan base specifically,
yes.
And that was part of your question, you know,
yes.
We have a great fan base in the United Kingdom. We have a great fan, I think our second largest fan base next to Canada and North America is in Israel, actually.
I find that so surprising.
Well, you know, social media doesn't hurt that, you know. Yeah. But this was our fifth time back to play right at a festival right on the Sea of Galilee, and it's every time. It's an amazing experience at Jacob's Ladder Festival. There's about 5,000 people that gather at this thing.
Okay.
But, you know, we have lots of, not just fans, but friends there, like, that we go and stay with because we've been able to stay in touch over online,
okay.
things like that. So I think there's
certainly,
lots of benefits.
Yeah, certainly connecting socially with your fans. We're in a time where that has been made so easy. And there's certainly the opportunity to be able to connect one-on-one with fans from all around the world is at a level now that was, you know, that's never been.
Right.
And so that separated from the way that technology has allowed for, you know, one's product to be able to be consumed, separating that from how, you know, socially you can connect with your fans through the technologies that we have today, it's certainly a very, very positive thing, I think, that one can connect so easily with people from Israel and overseas while you're here touring in the States. I mean, that is, I think that is definitely a benefit for any
for
of us.
Sure. It is quite remarkable. Yeah. I know that's kind of a global perspective, but I also see you guys are involved with community service projects.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you feel that your profile as an artist kind of carries a certain responsibility to do things at home, do things locally?
Well, that certainly adds to it. You know, in Kingston, having a profile and wanting to do something good out of that profile. But I think as people, John and I certainly naturally have a real concern for others and really care for our community and. Regardless of our involvement in music, I certainly, at least speaking for myself, would be involved in these sorts of things, regardless of, of playing music or not. But we, in our hometown, the last few years, I've been involved with a garden in Kingston that grows. A garden that grows produce for local charities in Kingston. There are a number of agencies in the Kingston area that have meal programs.
Yes.
So they're having fresh produce and being given to them is very helpful for them. Obviously, either they have meals on a weekly basis or even some have it daily. So. It's been a really amazing. I managed the garden for a number of years. So
he was
up at
dawn and he was working till dusk, like every day.
Yes, that's what it takes.
So, and with amazing. A garden with so much in flux, you have to be there for when the time is right.
Of course.
So that has been a really, and it's carrying forward certainly now that we're touring and we were recording this past year and. The certain obligations that we had sort of took away from a little bit of the time the last couple of summers, but it's continuing forward and it's such an amazing thing for the Kingston area.
Yeah, I think you're right though. We feel that we have a certain responsibility to people, you know, to make sure that we're using our profile for something good, and that's really it. And that we represent Child Fund in the United States and the Leprosy Mission of Canada in Canada. And that's just a way of giving back for us because we've been given so much.
Musicville, Ontario.
That's right. Yeah, right. That was
maybe
a few years
ago. You can talk about that.
No, well, that was.
Is this a musical education initiative?
It was well 3 years ago. It was in conjunction with the community garden, and we also raised money to be able to put toward music education programs in Kingston, and that was sort of part of a larger effort. We certainly support the Limestone Learning Foundation in Kingston, Ontario, where we're from.
Yes.
And we really feel that education is and making sure that kids get the best education they can is fundamental to the next generation of business leaders, of community leaders, of any contributors to society, right?
It's an excellent way to build an audience.
Exactly. Well,
a knowledgeable audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Sure. But really, we're very proud of the work that they do in Kingston, and so we've always tried to support, and mainly because they've always supported us. I mean, when we were younger,
as well,
touring, playing music as kids, we were always supported by our school board.
Yeah. Pay it forward, right?
Exactly. And so we always felt like, we know a lot of the bands here aren't so far from this, but you know, a lot of bands we'd play with, bluegrass bands throughout the States, especially kids our age. They would only be allowed to miss 3 days maximum of their school for the year and then they'd actually lose their seat at their school. Oh, like, think things like that.
Yeah,
right? And so for us to be able to take, sometimes we'd have to take a week to go and tour, and we'd just take our work with us. But our teachers and our administrators were always like, go, it's a great education, we support you guys.
Yeah.
So that's why we always try and pour back into education as best as we can through our music and help give kids, especially kids that are less fortunate, a leg up. Because music and learning go hand in hand. And we
Isn't
know that
right?
Yeah, first and foremost.
And post-secondary education as well, we have a tremendous respect and try to... Well, we continue to go to school while we tour, so... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we both go to Queen's University when we
Oh, okay,
right?
I didn't realize that.
So we also, you know, that's an example that we like to set, so that, you know, others, if there's younger, individuals that enjoy our music, they perhaps will see that you can pursue your dream and at the same time be able to continue with education and have that there as well.
That's a fantastic thing. Yeah. Just a couple of final questions. What can our audience expect to hear from your group this weekend?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we've talked about high-energy show, that's for sure, and we always try and entertain people. At the end of the day, people need to go home feeling entertained and that their lives have been touched. But you know what? It's an eclectic live show. I mean, we play anything from traditional bluegrass fiddle tunes all the way to Bob Dylan, Arlo Guthrie covers, to brand new songs that we've just written. We do, you know, we throw in a couple, like, covers. We do Avicii, Wake Me Up. We do Viva La Vida. We play, you know, I mean, so I think there's a little something for everybody. Whether you're, you know, 85 years old or you're, you know, 16, doesn't matter. Actually, we were just talking about this story last night. It was funny. We played Viva La Vida at this concert. We'll never forget. And it was in St. Thomas, Ontario, actually.
Okay.
This little town of St. Thomas. And this is a great example of all ages, because we finished playing this explosive version of Viva La Vida, and we were really giving her in this little church. And you know, we were kind of wondering how it went over, right? Because it was an older audience there. And after the show, this woman, she was 90, I think she was 90 or 92, something. She came up, she said, "I just love Coldplay." She said,
"You never know, eh?"
She said, "I love that Viva La Vida song." and you know what? It was just like, in that moment we said, you know, like, there's something for everybody here, even in the unexpected.
Yeah.
And I think that was, for us, we watched, we were fortunate enough to get to go hang out backstage at Neil Young's show in... at the Air Canada Centre in Toronto.
Oh, wow.
This is years ago now.
Yeah.
About 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And so we were hanging out backstage, and we got tickets to go up front and see, and just because Chris Brown, who produced our last couple records, has played with Neil on the road, you know, a couple tours and
keyboard
stuff.
Keyboard player.
Hey. Yeah, Hammond player, Hammond organ, the clavinet.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we were standing there in the audience, James and I, and we were loving Neil's show, but we were so preoccupied looking at the audience, and we literally saw... at least three generations of audience members. We'd see grandparents with their kids, with their grandkids, all listening to Neil Young.
That
we
was
said,
really special.
Yeah, we said, that's what we want.
Yes.
We want to be able to connect with audiences of all ages. And so that's what people can expect here. And you know, it's great. We've got all ages here at the Kluani Bluegrass Festival.
Right.
So
it's pretty special.
Well, thanks so much for spending some time chatting to me, you guys. It's really a pleasure.
We had a great time. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Abrams Brothers from Kingston, Ontario, talking to Steve Gedrose in the first of a series of interviews with bands appearing at the 2015 Kluani Mountain Bluegrass Festival. This and other interviews with bands performing at this festival are also available on our website, junctionjam.ca. Just click the Jam Live link. We would like to thank the Yukon Bluegrass Music Society for all their support. Also, a big thank you to Steve Gedrose, who prepared and conducted this interview. This show was brought to you by Junction Arts and Music, written and produced by Dieter Gade, and I am Maria Leniak. Thanks for joining us.